Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Nick Blumberg. It's Friday. We made it. And the Chicago Teachers Union appears to have made a deal, almost.
We are doing some of the hardest work in the world, which is educating the future generations.
After nearly a year of bargaining, teachers union negotiators mull over a potential contract.
This is an egregious breach of national security that put our servicemen and women's lives on the line, in danger.
Illinois Democrats join the chorus of critics over a national security breach that came via group text.
We're going to be returning education, very simply, back to the states where it belongs.
Attorney General Kwame Raoul joins an effort to block the Trump administration from dismantling the Education Department. The Chicago Police Department dramatically underreports traffic stops. A new study finds well-off voters hold more sway over property tax hikes. And
1-2 pitch. Got him swinging. Strike three.
One down, 161 to go. After a record season, in a bad way, the White Sox win their home opener against the Angels 8-1.
And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Jacoby Cochran from CityCast Chicago, our own Heather Sharone of WTTW News, A.D. Quigg from the Chicago Tribune, and joining us from Washington via Zoom is Clarence Page, Pulitzer-winning contributing columnist, also from the Chicago Tribune. Good to see you all. Let's get right to it. Heather Sharone, it's been about a week that we've heard a contract deal is imminent. It's on the precipice. It's almost here. We're running out of ways to say it. Where do things actually stand?
Well, there is appears to be a deal. The Chicago Teachers Union is an organization that prides themselves on being incredibly democratic. So there is a multiple step process before a contract could be agreed to. The first step is for the so-called big bargaining team to look at this deal. Now, if passes muster with that big bargaining team, then it goes to the executive committee of the teachers union, and then, and only then, does it go to the House of Delegates. But wait, there's one more step. It's got to go to the nearly 30,000 strong membership to either ratify or send everybody back to the negotiating table. However, it is a good sign that the bargaining team thinks that there's a deal on the table that they can take to the membership and ask them to approve.
Yeah, you have to imagine after a year they'd be pretty loath to present something to their members that they weren't going to get behind. You know, A.D. Quigg, there's also the small matter of the $175 million pension payment.
Just a tiny thing.
What's that among friends? That the Chicago Board of Education has not agreed to make, meaning it's still on the city's books, and there's a deadline fast approaching here, right?
Yes, end of the month is when the city's supposed to reconcile their books. So decide, take this is like the last opportunity for revenue to come in, expenses to be counted. Between March and June is when they reconcile everything and figure out how big their deficit is. So the mayor's office is saying we can figure this out basically on an accounting basis and move some things around. Chicago City Council, which has very low trust in the mayor's administration, especially around budget issues, said not so fast. You got to do everything with us over the next few months. Like you said, 175 is a big number. City says we don't know exactly if that will be the deficit number. We have to make sure what our expenses and revenues are. But regardless, it's a huge number on top of an already structurally imbalanced budget.
And it's a big change from what we had heard from the mayor
for
months, who was saying, look, CPS has to make this payment. Did I mention they have to make this payment? Mm-hmm. And he really put the full force of his bully pulpit behind sort of getting CPS to agree to a deal where essentially they would refinance about $240 million to not only cover this pension payment, but also, oh yes, pay for that contract that is apparently done and complete. Now, it's not clear whether the CPS board, which has said basically CPS can't take on any more debt, they have $9.3 billion worth of debt, but really they don't have any other way of paying for these teacher raises or new staff to do that. So do they maybe borrow enough to make some portion of the pension payment? I don't know, maybe.
And legally, the city is the one who is on the hook for making this payment. They have an intergovernmental agreement with CPS to do this, but there's nothing hard in state law. To be clear, the payment will be made. Those pensioners are getting that amount of money for this year. But yeah, it's just a matter of who's footing the bill ultimately.
Well, and Jacoby Cochran, the fact that the mayor hasn't been able to use that bully pulpit to persuade the Board of Education to see things his way, even though they've laid out all these different options, you know, is that a bad sign for Mayor Johnson?
I think in this case, you don't win everything. A year ago when these negotiations started, we didn't have a sense of exactly what would be in the contract. We didn't know if CPS CEO Pedro Martinez was long for the job. We didn't know who would make this pension payment. We didn't know what the hybrid school board would look like. Now the mayor is here on the goal line of what seems like a deal that has secured more teachers, more librarians, more support staff. We don't know yet if it includes more prep time for elementary school teachers, but it does look like some of those concessions were made. 4% cost of living increases over the duration of it. CPS CEO Pedro Martinez won't be in this position come next school year. The school board has already said they want to reinstate a superintendent certification for the next leader. And so you win some, you lose some, but the first time in 15 years, we do not have a strike looming, or it doesn't seem like we're going to have a strike this time around. And neither of the two mayors could say that. And so again, you win some and maybe to the tune of $175 million, you lose some.
Yeah, but at least something that the mayor can sort of take to his base and say, look at all the successes we achieved here.
We are remaking Chicago's education system with a new contract, a new leader, a new board. And so some of those things did come through.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, turning to an altogether very different topic, earlier this week we learned the National Security Advisor started a group chat on Signal, accidentally included the Atlantic's editor-in-chief and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in that chat, shared details of imminent attacks on Yemen. Clarence Page, what kind of a reaction are we seeing from the White House, from Congress, and how different is it to what we might have seen from prior administrations?
Well, besides my own reaction of jealousy that Jeff Goldberg got the story before I did, I mean, who among us in journalism would love to have a major newsmaker just by accident send us an internal chat, a Signal chat? That was what happened here. And now, this immediately started a good deal of consternation, to say the least. President Trump was one of the last to be advised of it, actually, and you could kind of tell when he was caught on camera reacting to it, saying Pete Hegseth is a heck of a guy, wonderful man, and after he was later informed about what was going on, that he went into the usual denials that Pete had done anything wrong, and it's been that kind of a race now. The old blame chase, we're all accustomed to that, but it's not over yet. There's still a question of whether or not some kind of a criminal investigation might be held. Pam Bundy, the new attorney general, was saying that wasn't in the cards right now, but there may be pressure for further investigation as to just how this whole goof up happened.
Right, because, you know, Trump sort of has this reputation, as does his administration, that these sorts of things that might have been a scandal for other folks just kind of slide right off of him. But, you know, Clarence, do you think this is the kind of story that has staying power, that, you know, it's not just going to disappear from the news cycle?
Well, as an Army veteran, I certainly think so. My view, and that of a lot of my friends, is quite firm about this. We all know what would happen if a low-ranking soldier, military personnel had made a goof like this. But it's not really totally clear as to exactly who let this slip out. The Mike Walls, who's the National Security Advisor, apparently put Jeff Goldberg on the list of people to be wired into this chat. It was a complete surprise to Jeff, but he was able to provide a transcript later of what was heard after all these denials came in that there was anything classified in this discussion. And you can see now from the transcript, which has been republished, of course, by Atlantic and others, that this was like a blow-by-blow of an attack in Yemen on Houthi rebels there, and with great details, very obvious what happened. And now the question is, how did word leak out like this? We're lucky that, at least as far as the American side, that this leakage didn't lead to one of our pilots being shot down. But the story continues.
Yeah, you have to imagine this is not going away. And by the way, if any elected officials want to drop any of us in their group chats, please, please feel free to.
Oh, leave me out.
All right, I'll take your spot. Another recent story out of D.C., we're still seeing some fallout from Senator Dick Durbin taking heat from progressives in particular for voting, along with nine other Democrats, to back a GOP budget patch that kept the government open. Heather Sharone, do you think this kind of heat he's taking factors into Durbin's own decision about whether he wants to run again?
I'm sure it does, because I think that there are a lot of Democrats that are sort of confronting a very different landscape today than existed a month ago or 2 months ago, and that has to be sort of part of the decision-making process. Dick Durbin was very reluctant to run for the term that he's serving now, and I think that if you talk to most Illinois politicos, they will say that he is not expected to run for another term. But we also would have said that about Toni Brackwinkle for Cook County Board President, and she is running again. And she will be, if she is elected, she will be in her 80s when she finishes this term. So I think there's a lot of questions about sort of how old is too old. I also think that, Illinois voters have been very confident in sort of reelecting the same person over and over again. That's sort of in our DNA as a people. The question is the chaos and the upset of the sort of first couple months of the second Trump administration changing that calculus? And I don't think we know the answer to that question yet.
Yeah. We also learned this week that the Trump administration planning to make hundreds of millions of dollars in cuts to public health funding for things like mental health care, substance abuse treatment, infectious disease prevention. A.D. Quigg, Governor Pritzker, has been on a media tour kind of blasting all these sorts of different cuts. Is this the kind of thing that, breaks through to the average voter, that you can understand, what is disease surveillance, those sorts of things?
I think it'll be tough for people to see and feel immediately. But the more cuts there are to more departments, I think people will start to feel it. It's just the responsibility of elected officials to point out, hey, this wouldn't have ended if we hadn't seen federal cuts the way we have from the Trump administration. But no, I don't think immediately we will see, there are a few hundred fewer people at the Chicago Department of Public Health. They won't know it then. But when we perhaps have a disease outbreak or folks aren't getting vaccinated like they should, then we'll start to see it. But it's going to be up to folks like Pritzker and other Trump opponents to point out the nexus of this.
Yeah. Well, and, as we mentioned, Attorney General Raul joining a suit aimed at preventing the Trump administration from dismantling the Department of Education. Jacoby Cochran, if you're the Attorney General, if you're Governor Pritzker, how do you balance sort of reacting to the onslaught of actions coming out of the Trump administration with, trying to run your own agenda?
I don't think you can. And I think that's the point of this onslaught from the Trump administration, is to put everyone on their back foot: governors, mayors, attorney generals, institutions. Even if these attorney generals are successful in reversing some of these actions, hundreds of people have taken buyouts. Hundreds of people have walked away. Thousands of people feel a lack of confidence in being able to go back to the federal government. It's so easy, or much easier, to dismantle something than it is to rebuild it. So even if another administration comes in years down the road and wants to rebuild robust systems at the public health office, at the U.S. Department of Education, for U.S. aid, well, how are they going to get that necessary $100 million spending package, billion-dollar spending package, through a gridlocked Congress to say we need to hire the thousands of people who were let go years ago? And so these consequences will be felt for the long haul. But I want the governor and the attorney general to, in addition to reacting, like you said, to balance their messaging and remind people this is a part of a decades-long strategy. To misinform millions of people, to make them feel disconnected from their government so that you can pull this type of funding from up underneath them, to pull these type of protections and systems from up underneath them, while deflecting and scapegoating and arresting political opponents and students. We have to get a better sense of what this full game plan is, how long we have been having this game run on us, and what their ultimate end plan is, which is in many ways to entrench the ruling billionaire class, who so many organizations are going to be cowing to for funding in lieu of hundreds of millions of dollars being cut across these agencies.
But to your point about, you know, those arrests of student protesters, things like that, Clarence Page, you had a column this week where you argued that, you know, the GOP has traditionally championed free speech, but you see the Trump White House is really trying to control what people can and cannot say, things like Gulf of Mexico versus Gulf of America. What kind of an effect can those attempts to influence the language people use have on our political discourse?
Well, it could have an interesting effect from several different angles. I don't know if Gulf of America is going to catch on, frankly, but we see that, that Google runs it both ways because they're an international service. Same thing with Reuters, AP, the various news services are still saying Gulf of Mexico or saying saying both. But you could go on with a number of changes that Donald Trump wants to make in our language and in recognizing who gets what benefits from the government. He's certainly on an anti-DEI kick in which virtually anything that happens to have racial or other ethnic integration is the enemy. And that doesn't hurt him with his base. I won't say it helps him that much, but it doesn't hurt him with his base. And it's creating a whole atmosphere of hostility around the White House as far as a lot of people are concerned. And so it's going to be one more question of distraction, which is Trump has often been called the master of distraction, and we've got a lot of them now.
Well, and Clarence, in your piece, you mentioned, you know, what Jacoby brought up is, you know, the folks being, you know, rounded up and, you know, detained because of their participation in pro-Gaza protests. Is it fair to say that you expect to see more of those kinds of tactics?
Well, there were three of them that I wasn't even really that much aware of. But when you look at the details of people who have been people who have been picked up by ICE, who are also one case is a naturalized citizen, but because she participated in a protest, she's in custody. We have the fellow who you probably have heard about who had tattoos that were similar to those of street gangs as far as the ICE agents were concerned, and he got hauled away, and he's still in custody as far as I know. These kind of stories, these kind of horror stories, reminds us of the days of Stalin in Russia. But it's happening right here around us in our own country. And I don't know how long this is going to go on. People are surely fighting this in court, but it's just, once again, a crisis that seems to be manufactured.
Well, turning to some local news, Heather Sharon, you reported this week Chicago police underreported how many traffic stops officers made last year, a couple hundred thousand of them. How did that kind of an error happen?
Well, when Chicago police officers make a traffic stop, they're supposed to do two things. One, they've got to call it into the dispatch center, and they've got to fill out what's called a blue card. And that card is supposed to record sort of the reason for the stop and the demographic information about the driver. Now, in 200,000 cases, it's not clear that whether blue cards were filled out and submitted to the state as required. Now, Chicago police say they made about 300,000 traffic stops, and those are documented with the state. That's almost a 45% reduction from the year before, and Superintendent Larry Snelling has said, look, police officers need to be making targeted stops designed to find violent crime and arrest criminals. The question is, if the police department isn't fully documenting all of those stops, which is what the sort of comparison between the blue cards and the dispatch reports suggest, can this really be reformed? And that is very much a topic of conversation for the federal court, which of course has ordered the Chicago Police Department to address these sort of issues.
Well, you know, for a department that's still operating from a trust deficit, you know, with many Chicagoans, you know, Jacoby Cochran, do these sorts of reporting failures just make their job that much more difficult? Or, you know, do folks hear this story and maybe think they underreported what?
Chicago's police department has a, correct me if I'm wrong, 9% compliance with its federal consent decree. And I'll be real, I joined alongside hundreds and thousands of advocates who, even when this consent decree was put in place, said it would not do enough to not only build back trust that, I don't know, at least in my community, hasn't been there my entire life, but would push the Chicago Police Department towards some broad sense of reforms and accountability. And traffic stops weren't even rounded up in that decree. And so they're not meeting federally mandated reforms. They're not working to capture what I would think are some of the most basic interactions they have with Chicagoans. Traffic stops, something I've been trained about since I was 7 years old in this city. And so when I hear the Chicago Police Department celebrating a 45% reduction, and then you basically go in their closet and all of the trash that your mom told you to like clean up and organize and put away is just sort of, oh, there's 200,000 arrests, don't look at those. I mean, it makes me continue the amount of skepticism and frustration that I live with every day.
Yeah. Well, Eddie Quigg, Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas' office, out with a new study this week on property taxes, particularly the importance of voting. What did they find?
Basically, that wealthy white homeowners are more likely to vote in property tax referenda. So this could be allowing your local government a higher debt limit to borrow more money, or a specific infrastructure project they want you to vote on. Basically, white people turn out more, white rich homeowners. So that means folks with the lowest income aren't voicing their opinion on things that are going to raise their taxes, something they can least afford. So this is a hobby horse of Treasurer Pappas, who's responsible for mailing out bills and often bears the brunt of people saying, why is my bill up so much? So she started doing these every year to kind of prove to people how important this could be and try to get people to turn out. So all these municipal elections are coming up next month. If you care about your property taxes, find out whether your municipality has a property tax involved referendum and go all the way to the bottom of your ballot.
Yeah, a lot of them coming up on Tuesday.
I was going to say time is a flat circle. It is actually Tuesday. Oh, a lot of us
which
suburban.
Is next month.
Yes. Yes. It is next month.
Like it or
yes.
not, ready yes. or not for it. All right, well, I want to end on some fun notes. CityCast celebrating its 1,000th episode. Congratulations.
Thank you.
With the list of 1,000 things that we love Chicago, because if there's one thing we love as much as our city, it's debating a list. how did the idea for this come about?
About 5 months ago, our executive producer, Simone Ali Sayre, really just sort of threw it out there. What if, in celebration of 4 years of making this podcast and newsletter and 1,000 episodes, we name 1,000 things? And so over the last 5 months, we've gathered 20, 30, 40 things a day, some days less because of how busy we were. And we ultimately put it together. And some of my favorites are Calling People Goofies, the Katie Got Vance Dance, Just Relax by King Louie. Remember my mom pick up like a Sun Times or a Tribune paper from the man standing in the middle of the street selling like bananas.
Made me nervous every
and
time.
Oranges. Eddie Quigg and Heather Sherrill are two of our most visited guests over the last 4 years
it's
in the
honor.
Double Digit Club.
Yeah.
To explain everything from corruption trials to property tax assessments, and we really appreciate them. And the list has something for everybody in the city of Chicago.
Well, one of my favorite ones that people love about Chicago is Midwest friendliness. Eddie Quigg is a non-Chicagoan Midwesterner. Uh-huh. Your thoughts on that matter?
No comment.
Oh, come on. If we are not behind the wheel of the car, we are pretty nice. We give directions.
Yeah.
We tell you about yourselves.
I've traveled
which I think
quite
is
a
important.
Bit. I think Chicago is the nicest big city in the country.
As long as you're not saying anything mean about Chicago.
Right.
Well, because then we're going to
fight
you.
Why would you, though?
Number one entry, how much Chicagoans love Chicago.
Yes.
Confirm or deny, Heather Sherrill.
Confirm.
Jacoby, another one of your entries, which I loved, downing a beer on the walk from parking lot G to Comiskey.
Yes.
Speaking
I have
of,
done it over and over.
Oh, I've been there. Sox beat the Angels 8-1 in their home opener yesterday. Oh. After an abysmal season last year,
uphill. What you're talking about.
Okay, so all uphill. Hope for the season.
Come on,
everything's in the past.
Eight scoreless innings, 3 home runs. The crowd was rocking. Right, everybody got their nachos. Right, it was a great day on the South Side. It's good to put a W there. I think we should take each one as they come. We got 160 games left. Just like HW, enjoy every L. Just like, again, put it in the closet.
That's
with all
really
the other things
attitude.
Behind the way.
It is.
It's
like goldfish. Like, you know,
every day,
just it's a brand new day.
Wipes the slate clean.
Yes.
And another moment of success, Bulls with the buzzer beater win over the Lakers. It's, you know, I'm not following them that closely, but 9 out of the last 11, should we be sitting up and taking notice?
I love that they can win 9 out of the last 11 with players like Coby White, Giddey, Buzelis playing amazing, and we're still, like, fighting for 8th, 9th, 10th place, like 7-8 games under 500. Hey, one of the hottest teams in the game right now. The young players look good. I wish we would just invest in them, like, invest in them. But, hey, they're doing the best they can with what they got.
Yeah, we're in, what, a decade 3 of the rebuilding post-Jordan, it feels like. So.
Maybe the play-in hasn't stopped some teams over the last few years, so maybe we find ourselves in the first round matchup against, I don't know, the Cavs or something.
Empires we'll take a while, Nick.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. And you know what? We made LeBron grumpy, even if we don't get anywhere past this. But you all made us, and hopefully the viewers, very happy. We are out of time, so our thanks to Jacoby Cochran, Heather Sharone, A.D. Quigg, and from Washington via Zoom, Clarence Page. We're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family. The Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
And that's our show for this Friday night. Don't forget, you can get Chicago Tonight and The Week in Review streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website. That's WTTW.com/news. Now for The Week in Review, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay informed. Have a great weekend. Okay, 9 of the submissions I counted were about spring, which feels very appropriate today as we got up into the 70s. Any big plans to enjoy this beautiful weather?
Snow still.
Heather.
It just is.
Happy birthday to my mom. Oh, it was yesterday. Had a birthday party. So
all right.
That's nice. The tulips are coming.
That's true.
I have no plans. I'm working morning shift tomorrow.
Oh, all right. Better you than us. I think this counts as second fool's spring if it gets up into the 70s, but yeah, we know it's going to dip right back down again, so we just got to enjoy
it. Until May 15th, I accept no proclamations of spring.
That's a long time.
I've been burned too many times.
Yeah, that's probably a safe way to hedge one's bet.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to give back to its community in Chicago and beyond.